Hey everyone, I'm Dave Sandell.
I'm Caleb Gardner.
And this is the Best Album For podcast, a podcast where we talk about the best album for apologizing to your kids. Caleb, this one was one of yours. So why don't you walk us through why you wanted to talk for an hour about apologizing to your kids?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure that I had just done this when we were talking about this topic. So it's probably just really top of mind for me. But like, we, you and I talked a few times over the years about like the exquisite awkwardness, but super importance of telling that your kids that you are wrong and apologizing, right? Like modeling that. It's not easy. It's not easy out here being a parent and trying to model emotional intelligence and health to your kids. We're out here trying to break cycles.
Right. I was not used to being apologized to as a kid, so I've had to learn, like, okay, repairing is really important. It's okay to not be an awesome parent all the time, but you have to go back and repair that. You can't just let that slide. So there's been, like, all these articles and essays and podcasts we've listened to about apologizing to your kids and repairing. And there's like the 5-step process that you're supposed to model. And you're supposed to like teach them how to apologize to each other with, you know, that same, you know, discover what it is you're sorry for. Don't just say sorry, you know, like really think about what affected the other person, how you can make it better. Do you guys go through the whole rigmarole when you do the apology?
Oh yeah. Every time. No, absolutely not. A 5-step process. Just like stressed me out. I was like, what the hell? What have I been doing wrong about this the whole time?
Wait, so how long do apologies take?
Like for me apologizing to my kid or my kids apologizing to each other?
Both.
I mean, kids apologizing to each other is tough, obviously, because kids never want to elaborate. Like, you know, you don't want to force them into an apology, but you do want to kind of prompt it, right? And then it's like, sorry. You know, like it's like not.
Oh, you get some contriteness, though. That's nice. We often get sorry.
I mean, sometimes. Buddy. Yeah. No. Yes. Yeah. The emotions are all over the place. Let's be honest.
Do you ask for forgiveness? Like, do you say the words, will you forgive me?
When I'm apologizing to my kids, I don't think that I do. And the main reason is I feel like that puts it back on them in a way that like. You know, like puts a lot on their shoulders, like what are they gonna say? No, like you know what I mean.
So our kids have learned to say no. They like sometimes they're like, I don't accept your apology, or I don't forgive you, or more often, I'm not ready to forgive you yet. I was like, well, that's fair.
Yeah, I mean that's fair. What's the I just don't know what I'm asking them to model. If I was like, will you forgive me? Like, I here's the thing is I've got some super sweet like anxious kids, and I feel like I would be pressuring them into saying yes. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And I feel like I'm making it about me if I did that versus like it just being about my contriteness, I guess.
Yeah, that makes sense. Pause 1 second. What's up, buddy? What do you need, bud? I'm on my call. You can have it one.
Yes.
But remember what I asked you to do? Not
no.
Bother me?
Sorry.
Thank you. I forgive you.
That's staying in. We're keeping that in the pod.
Oh, boy. That's good. You know, I'm a former pastor, and that'll come up from time to time, so I might as well just own it real quick. And, like, forgiveness is a big part of my, like, you know, life's worldview. It's, like, a really important thing that we often forget about in, you know, in the world, in, like, our culture. And so I think we try to model, like, will you forgive me? But, yeah, it's super, like, it puts the onus back on them. Like, okay, I've done my part, so now it's all
exactly.
on you.
Exactly.
A little weird.
All right, step up. Step up, 5-year-old. How did you approach, like, thinking about the music for this situation? This was a really tough, like, I didn't think this would be such a tough topic, but it was actually a really tough topic for me to, like, work through.
First thing I did was a very basic, what songs in my catalog have the word sorry in them? That was the first step. It's like, this is not how we approach this podcast. What am I doing? I just had a really hard time like finding an album. I almost always go with what is the vibe in the room that I want when I'm doing the activity that we're talking about. And so what is the vibe in the room that I want when I'm apologizing to my kids, I think is where I was landing. But then I also thought about like, apologizing is not necessarily a short thing, but it isn't an hour long thing. Like, I hopefully am not apologizing for an hour. Sure. Although maybe there's been an occasion where that's happened. So then I started thinking about like the stress cycle, or like letting kids kind of go through all the gamut of emotions. Like, tell me how I made you feel, you know? And I thought like, well, what if I can kind of capture some of the like, okay, now we're repaired. Now we're back together and we're friends again and everything is okay. And you feel loved. Like, what if I can capture some of that in an album? I thought that would be a fun way to approach it. And then I realized that most albums, one or two things is true. Either there's a really good song that I'd like playing while I was apologizing, and the rest of the album will not sustain that. For example, Cher's If I Could Turn Back Time, great apology song. Rest of the album, I'm not going to play that while I'm apologizing to my kids. Or the other thing that happened is that everything is about sex. Like, I really wanted to pick Bitter by Michelle and Diego Cello. That was the album that first came to my head of like, oh, this is the vibe that I want in the room when I'm apologizing to my kids. But like 75% of the lyrics are like not explicit, but clearly not about me apologizing to a child. You know, like that couldn't possibly be happening. So I had to throw all that out, and I tried to find an album where I'm actually apologizing to a kid, as opposed to leaning into, well, I guess we're just going to hope this goes over your head.
Yes, I found very similar things in terms of like having the exact right song that would be great, but in the context of the album didn't work great. And similarly, I like, of course, one of my first thoughts was, oh, On Bended Knee, you know, Boyz II Men, On Bended Knee, yeah. Which is preceded by I'll Make Love to You. On that album, like, oh, maybe not.
How did you, anything else you want to say about how you approached thinking about finding an album for apologizing to your kids?
Yeah, I think that I similarly was looking for, started with like, who's just saying I'm sorry, like what are good apology songs? But you're right, like nothing really felt, for apologizing to your kids, it's such a like specific scenario that nothing really felt 100% right, because it all felt like in the context of an adult relationship, whether sexual or not. And similarly, like I would find a really great song, but then the entire album didn't really work. So I think I took an approach similar to you, where it was like, I think that what I want from my children in that scenario is to be able to express a wide gamut of emotions, right? Like to be able to feel whatever they want to feel in that moment. Anger at me, sad, happy at the fact that I'm trying to repair the relationship. And so I kind of went with something that where I felt like there was the opportunity to be like, fuck you, I'm not ready to right, you know, forgive you. But also forward looking, happy, like we've repaired this, everything's going to be okay. So that's kind of how I landed on what I'm going to talk about. But this was a tough, I admit it. Like when we were originally talking about this topic, I did not expect it to be so tough that you and I are the authorities on this subject and have found the definitive albums for this exact situation.
And the off chance that somebody actually needs to find an album for apologizing to your kids, I think we are actually doing a service this week, because this was a tall task.
Exactly. Also, just a reminder, apologize to your kids.
Yeah.
Just do it.
Okay. Just do it. Take a second now. Do you have anything you need to apologize for? You can pause the podcast. Just go apologize to your kids, then come back and you can argue with us about if we picked the right album.
Yeah.
Or if you wait till this is over and go put on one of our albums and report back on how it went. Please.
Please make your child listen to the entire album and then give us feedback.
We need 45 minutes of sustained apology. Caleb, why don't you jump in with yours first?
All right. I chose for my album this week about what to listen to while apologizing to your children, an album called In Defense of My Own Happiness by Joy Oladokun. A singer-songwriter who is just a delight. Like, I don't know. Like, there's albums that you can put on in the background of almost any situation, and they feel right for it. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's I think of this as like a Saturday morning. I'm, you know, reading something. My kids are out, like, it's kind of relaxed, and I'm putting on something that is just like enjoyable, but also, again, kind of experiencing a wide range of different kinds of emotions, but something that I can both listen to with intention and put on in the background. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's one of those.
So you're actually like setting the mood. Like, you're.
I think so.
You're like creating a scenario where you're actually, hey, this would be a good time to apologize to my kids. Prime of the pump.
Yeah, sure.
Get that forgiveness.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm actually, what I was trying to say is, on a Saturday morning, I'm about to do something I need to apologize for. I honestly, do you know what I mean, though? That there are, like, albums that are, like, if I'm going to listen to this, it's got to be a really intentional where I'm sitting down and I'm into the music. And then there's albums where I could be into this, or I could just put it on and it's okay. It's not going to, like, it's going to be something, I don't want to call it enjoyable background music, because that makes it sound like, you know, elevator music or something that's not good, but it's just like,
right,
everybody's going to enjoy this.
Yeah, it would. I mean, certainly there's a certain type of person who would not enjoy this, but
sure.
Listeners of this podcast will almost certainly love this album. It's hard to believe that anybody could put this on and not be at least enjoy it, if not moved by it.
Yeah. And I mean, what I love about Oladokun specifically is, you know, she's a Black queer singer-songwriter. Like, she especially, you know, has a lot of great storytelling in these songs. A lot of great melodies and, you know, lyricism's really good. When I was listening to this, you know, we were still in the middle of a pandemic. We were like having a hard year. It was one of those albums that hit for me as just something that had such humanity in it. Especially with songs like Look Up, which was on, you know, the second half of this double-sided album that came out in 2021. Just something that you need to hear on a hard day. And I think that's why I was drawn to this album ultimately for this topic, was like, I'm apologizing, I'm letting my children experience all of these emotions, but what do I want them to walk away with, right? And Look Up is one of those songs that's just like, hey, we've repaired this, it's all gonna be okay. There's people out there that love you and care about you, including me, who's like, you know, prostrating myself in front of you to tell you I want to repair this relationship. That's kind of the emotion that I want you to end on. Like, you can experience lots of things. Like, there's an aptly named song on this great album called Sorry Isn't Good Enough. Like, if they want to draw from that, it's a great song. You know, then they are allowed to, but ultimately we're gonna be okay. That's kind of how I feel after this.
Tell me more about, just where does this album fit for you, like, in your tastes? Are you generally a folk music guy, or does it have to be like another special sauce ingredient? Like, what is your approach to folk music?
Yeah, I'm not usually a folk music guy. That's why I think this album hit me in a context that, like, was really resonant, which is, you know, again, having a hard time in the pandemic. I don't, you know, a bunch of other things in life were hard at that time, and it just like felt comforting. But yeah, I'm not usually drawn to folk or even like singer-songwriter types. I mean, my taste mostly, I think, is music with a little bit more of an edge. Mm-hmm. You know, that edge can be lots of things. Like, it could be a, you know, hard dance edge, it can be a punk edge, it can be, you know, metal edge. Those are usually my go-tos, but I don't know. This really, it was just like a ray of sunshine I guess, at the right time of life here. I have found that in the last few years, again, maybe this is context dependent, that I've kind of gone back and revisited some singer-songwriters, some folk music, some more kind of softer, melodic, very, you know, acoustic guitar-driven kinds of sounds, including Anarchist Gospel by Sonny War, which just came out and I am really into right now. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe this is part of me aging, but I am kind of like just filling out the rainbow of things that I listen to, including things that are a little bit more, I almost like softer sound, but the lyricism is still so good in terms of how it draws you in. Are you familiar with Joy Ladekun? Like, had you listened to this before?
No. I actually, when you sent me this, I was very surprised because I literally had never heard of this record, which I guess in hindsight wasn't that shocking because it didn't chart very high at the end of the year for people. But then also it's just not my genre. I was super excited to listen to it. Of course, I love your taste. And so, you know, I thought the first half of this record, which my understanding is came out in 2020 and it is more acoustically driven, it was really beautiful. It was a beautiful record. There were a lot of she was doing a lot of things with spirituality, where, you know, previous, you know, like, reference our previous conversation is a pull right. for me, and I was really drawn to it. And then it switched about halfway through the record, which I now understand was the 2021 record that she, you know, put both of these together to create one gigantic record, which is the one that we're talking about in full here. But the halfway through that record, somebody that I used to be comes up, and suddenly it's just brighter, and there's, you know, there's some percussion going on underneath it that was interesting, and it came very alive. I thought, oh, this is really getting to me. And then, like, you know, that kind of special sauce lasted over the rest of the album, and I was really taken with it. I've listened to this a few times this week, and told my wife to listen to it too, because I think she's going to love it as well. She's a really special artist. I'd love to hear more, you know, down the road of what she's going to do. And my understanding is she's,
got a new album coming out.
Does she?
Yeah. In April.
There you go. Have you seen her live?
No, I wish. No, I haven't seen her live yet. I haven't seen her come to Chicago. I don't know if she's been to Chicago or not.
I saw her that she performed at the White House when I was putzing around on YouTube.
During the Trump administration, obviously.
Oh, like, was it? No.
Oh, no, I don't know.
I fall for that? Good Lord. No. During the Biden administration.
I heard that Trump is really into singer-songwriter folk types, actually.
Tell me, I want to talk about this genre a little more broadly for a minute. Tell me about, like, who are your favorite kind of indie folk artists that you come back to time and again?
Ooh, good question. I mean, again, not really my genre, so I wouldn't say I come back to them a lot. Mm-hmm. I used to be, I used to be very into Sufjan Stevens back in, you know, his Come On, Feel the Illinois days. So I guess that still can be in rotation for me. I really thought in college, I want to say, that Damien Rice was like the pinnacle of singer songwriter types. Now I don't think I hold him in as much esteem as I did back then. I think a lot of his stuff feels like it's still good, but it just feels like, I don't know, not as complicated as maybe I was feeling it, you know, when I was a college student.
Of course. Yeah, and a then lot there's, of this of course, music lends itself to kind of that college, post college, like, take yourself 100%. Very seriously.
Yes.
Which isn't necessarily a dig on it. It's just, that's just where it sits for me.
Take yourself very seriously is exactly right. I mean, they're all trying to be one version of Joni Mitchell or another.
Right.
You know, or Bob Dylan.
Elliot Smith.
Yeah. But like, I think that's why I love this record. Like, because there are parts that where she's taking the subject matter very seriously. And then there are parts where she is like adding levity and saying like, it's going to be all right. Like, don't take things so seriously. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think that's also why I love her as an artist. And so I'd love to see her live at some point. But I don't know. I feel like there's some really good artists like Joy Oladokun, like Sonny War in this genre right now, who are kind of bringing this it kind of reminds me of like country music in the 50s, you know, where it was like this underground, very like folksy, but like of the people kind of sound.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Where it was like, it was kind of dangerous. Yep. And then it became eventually this overproduced kind of nonsense. But back then, you know, in the Patsy Cline kind of days, it was like tapping into something. And I think that there's the fact that a lot of the most interesting artists in this genre right now are Black and queer feels like subversive in a way where they're kind of like taking this in really interesting places.
Yes, I agree with that. I mean, I mentioned Michelle Negocello earlier. That's a touch point for me in this genre. As a kid, at least, like that was where I first thought, oh, this is really beautiful. And I can hang with an album that's pretty low key for an hour and just focus on the lyrics and focus on the kind of minor is the wrong word for this, but the minor changes in tone and ambience and sound. Because, you know, if I just have it on the background, something can just sound like the same song for an hour. But if I'm like bringing it to the foreground and actually listening to it, I find some really special things. I'm really into, Phoebe Bridgers, of course, whose Stranger in the Alps record is more of an indie folk than Punisher, which is doing something a little different. Angel Olsen's older stuff. She's always kind of leaned into alt country type spaces, but she didn't fully lean into that until the last few records. And so,
yeah, definitely heavy into that now.
Yeah. And then another one that I really, have you ever heard of Ned Collette? This might come up on this podcast at some point because I really love this record.
Oh, that sounds familiar. Why would I?
So Ned Collette is I'm going to look it up real quick while we're talking about it. But he's a folk artist who makes a lot of music that's not folk artist-y, which is a terrible way to say it. He's from, he's in Berlin now. He was from Australia originally.
I think you flagged this album to me back in the day.
Yeah, so this record really got me. For like 3 years, I just listened to Jokes and Trials like on repeat over and over again. There's a song called Laughter Across the Streets, which I will just like take me away to some other more beautiful world that I live in right now. But nobody's ever heard of that record. And it always bothered me that like nobody's heard of it. He never tours. I don't even think he makes much music anymore. He made a few albums after that were good, but very different sounding. But there is an old publication, old website called Coke Machine Glow that I kind of worshipped at the altar of for a long time. Anything that they recommended, I found a way to love it. So like the Subtle record, I don't know if you remember the Subtle record or like the Black Up by Shabazz Palaces. These are records that they really loved. And so I like absorbed them into my identity. And Ned Collette was definitely one of those. So he's kind of my like pinnacle of this genre. But I really loved this record, this Joy Ladekun record.
Yeah. You made me think of something earlier when you were talking about like our childhood. And I was like, how have we not already talked about Tracy Chapman in relation to this album too? I mean, like that to me feels like in this, what's the word I'm looking for where, in the family evolution of, you know, where we are now with Joy Ladekun, like Tracy Chapman's got to be in there.
Yeah.
You got to imagine her lineage. Having Tracy Chapman lineage. Why was that a hard word to come up with? You got to imagine Joy Ladekun having Tracy Chapman in her headphones growing up as well.
For sure.
There's no way. Anyway.
For sure.
We got to at some point talk about Tracy Chapman's self-titled album from the 80s because awesome.
Well, speaking of our childhoods, I'm going to dive into my pick, which is my first record I'm going to talk about from the 90s. Anytime that I get to talk about something that was released in the 90s when it was kind of my formative years of music, I'm going to like sound the alarm of this is a very special episode of Best Album 4. This is not one of my favorite records, although I listened to the hell out of this record when I was a kid and certainly think it's a masterpiece. I'm going to talk about The Cranberries' No Need to Argue. So first of all, Cranberries, are they a big band for you?
They weren't a big band. I mean, I definitely, obviously they were such a presence around this time with Zombie being everywhere. And I have these like cultural memories of them, which is weird. Like I remember them being referenced in the movie Clueless, like this guy, this like popular guy was like asking about his Cranberries album. Don't ask me why that stuck in my head, but it definitely stuck in my head. So that's, this is like right around the Clueless era of pop culture. And then I remember,
yeah, for sure.
So weird. I remember, I've got a memory of my, my wife's cousin. I don't know what relation that would be to me. Us going to my wife's cousin's house when we were dating, and him being really obsessed with the Cranberries. But the context that makes this weird is this was like 2006. So this is way after this album came out. And he is French. This was in France. He was listening. He was watching a concert of the Cranberries, and it was like dubbed. And I was like, what is happening right now? This is weird. This is wild. Anyway, I mean, I guess I shouldn't be surprised that, like, they are a European band. They're from Ireland. I don't know why I feel ownership over them as an American, but it still felt weird at the time.
I mean, certainly Dolores O'Riordan is considered, like, an icon of all music, even though I think this is probably their last record that is universally adored. From here, it was kind of a decline in quality. But when she passed away a few years back in 2018, I think, there was an outpouring of love for her and how much she specifically influenced so many other female artists of the 90s. It sounded like, you know, you don't get Alanis Morissette without Dolores O'Riordan first. And, you know, I listened to this record and it's so Irish. It's so like folksy and beautiful and just in my feels that it just kind of puts me in this place of I'm ready to really consider the deep things about my life. You know, at this point in my life, this is 1994. So I'm almost exclusively listening to like grunge music and kind of the beginnings of what's going to happen after grunge. But 94 is like when Kurt Cobain dies. And so this is like the zenith, the pinnacle. Holes, you know, Live Through This comes out. Super Unknown comes out. Stonewall Pilots, Purple, Vitalogy by Pearl Jam. Like, these are all like the Dave Sandell canon when I was, you know, I guess 14 years old. Like, I was just listening to all those records over and over again. Radiohead doesn't exist, but they don't exist. You know, the Benz doesn't come out to 95. And so when I bought No Need to Argue, I bought it on the strength of Zombie. And I loved Dreams and I loved Linger off of their previous record. Those songs like live in my brain somewhere as like the dreamiest, most blissful pieces of music that I've ever encountered. And I have this like really clear memory. I was really into My So-Called Life. Did you ever watch that show?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So classic. That show like did something to me, I guess. Which feels weird as like a dude. I mean, not that I can't enjoy it, but just that show wasn't necessarily for me, but it felt so personal and profound. And there was nothing about Angela's life that resonated with me. Like no part of it felt true to my life experience, except for the part where I felt misunderstood and lonely and, you know, not really sure how to navigate the waters of being you know, a high school kid in 1994. And there's a scene where her mother comes in to talk to her about she has a boyfriend now and she wants to know, you know, if they're having sex, she wants to make sure that they're using protection. And that's a really, you know, that's a big conversation in 94 to put on a mainstream TV show. And Dreams is playing in the background, like Cranberry's Dreams is playing in the background of that whole scene. And it's really loud. Like Angela's laying on her bed and she's listening to it on like full volume. And her mom knocks and she comes in and she like goes over and she kind of sways with music for a minute. Then she turns it down and Angela says, you can turn it off. And she goes, no, I like it. And that felt like such a sweet, tender moment of like a mother connecting with her child. Like, I'm here to listen to the music that you love. I just want you to turn it down a little bit. That I think I implanted this somewhere in my brain as this music can be shared between generations. This is the strangest connection I've ever made in my head. But this week, as I was thinking of best album for Apologizing to Your Kids, I thought I want a situation where I'm connecting with my daughter or my sons and the Cranberries are playing in the background. And specifically, I want Ode to My Family playing in the background, which is this like doot. It's really like lovely, soft, still, beautiful record, except for the lyrics are pretty intense. Like she's basically saying, you know, here's her whole life that's full of hurt and pain and love and joy. And she sort of ripped it open to pour into her lyrics. And there's like this media scrum that came around her, you know, on the back of Everybody Else Is Doing It, So Why Can't We? And that album blowing up. And just kind of breaking her down and sort of using her for parts, like not really considering the whole person of her, but almost kind of building this character of her. And my understanding of this song is that she's basically saying, like, my father loved me. Does anybody care about that? My mom was there for me when, you know, I was out there on my own trying to figure things out. Does anybody care about that? There's something about this record that made me feel very close to my family. And so that's the song that it came to. But then there's the issue of 15 minutes into this record, Zombie comes in. And Zombie is just the coolest, you know, most thrashy, like, hardcore anti-war anthem that I'd ever heard when I was a 14-year-old. And imagining, like, putting this on in the background while I'm apologizing to my kids and that taking a little too long and Zombie coming on really, really paints a picture in my head of what now? And so here's my pitch. My pitch is, if your apology to your kids is taking longer than 15 minutes, then you really messed up and they need to get some rage out. And so you say, hey, we're going to pause this conversation for 5 minutes and you're going to listen to Zombie and you're going to get all in your feels and get really angry and let it all out. And then we'll come back to the table and you can tell me all the ways that you're pissed at me one more time.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. I'm imagining like rage dancing around the bedroom, you know, while you're like getting into your body and just feeling the emotions. I really like that. That's quite a contrast, like between let's enjoy this together as a family, and then let's I don't know, like be in our rage together.
So there's this interesting thing that happens on this record where so Zombie is this massive hit, right? And it's so different than anything that they've done before.
Point where, like, that's the song I associate with the Cranberries now.
Of course. And it's, there's nothing else like it in their entire catalog. I mean, maybe there's like a later record where they tried to recreate that magic. I'm not sure. I lost touch with the Cranberries, you know, after The Faithful Departed. I might have listened to Buried a Hatchet, but I don't think I spent much time with it. And I remember feeling like, you know, so Zombie is the lead single and it's this huge song. And so, you know, buying records in the 90s was a very different experience than listening to music in 2023. Because first of all, records cost a ton of money. Like if I wanted to buy a CD or even a cassette, like I had to have like upwards of $20 to do that.
Yeah.
And $20 back then is a lot more than $20 now. Like my kids don't have $20 all the time, but they have $20 sometimes. When I was a kid, I like never had $20. Like if I mowed my grandma's lawn, I did not get $20. Like if 100%. I mowed our lawn and her lawn, I didn't get $20. Like I didn't have $20 in my pocket regularly until I started working like real jobs, which was when I was 14, but not quite when this record came out. And so I remember this experience of going to our local disc jockey. I probably talked about this before. And like assessing all of the music that I want. And I was an MTV junkie. My parents, this is a little bit about my origin story. My parents banned MTV in our house. They like called the cable company and had them like block the channel.
What?
Yeah.
Is that and a thing so, you could do?
It was. And so I spent any time that I was at my friend Kurt's house, I just made him put MTV on and I just like soaked in all the music. And eventually they like undid that. And so I don't know how, if they undid it or if the cable company undid it, but I like secretly had MTV then for many, many more years and just watched MTV constantly. And so there's lots of records that I want. Right. And I, at this point in my life, really deeply love music, like starting about 92, we'll get into this later, but starting in 92, like music has become like, I'm not going to overstate it as like my reason for living, but it's a reason for living. Like it was one of the best things in my life. And so I'm assessing, you know, here's all the records that I want to buy. And I'm not exactly sure when this record came out, but here's what I know. I know Communication came out that year. And that's one of my top like 20 records of all time. Like there's tons of amazing records. I'm going to go through some of these. So you have Bad Religion's Stranger in Fiction. You have Vitalogy. You have Jeff Buckley's Grace, which they played on a loop on MTV on this like MTV Buzzbin commercial that lives in my head. you know, you have Portishead's Dummy, which I loved. You have Outkast, Southern Playlist of Cadillac Music. You have Super Unknown. You have the first Roots album. Do you want more? You have Dookie. Freaking Green Day's Dookie comes out this year. The Downward Dookie. Spiral. Like, this is the beginning of, not the beginning of Nine Inch Nails, but the beginning of mainstream Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah.
You know, Notorious B.I.G.'s Ready to Die, which I wasn't allowed to buy, but I definitely bought. CLC's Crazy Sexy Cool, Weezer's first record, Illmatic comes out. I mean, there's just album after album, Smash, Offspring. And then there's a bunch of other records that are really good, but that I didn't care about at that point. Like, there's a Nick Cave record that's classic and, you know, Underworld record that I now dearly love. And, you know, there's other things. There's Tom Petty's Wildflowers. There's Bush's 16 Stone. I'm just listing records now because I love listing records. And if you don't like listening to me listing records, you might, this podcast might not be for you. All that is to say, and there's even more. All that is to say is I walked into Disc Jockey with my $20 and had to decide what to spend it on. And what I spent it on was Zombie. And I got No Need to Argue for Zombie. And I brought No Need to Argue to home and I listened to Ode to My Family. And it was beautiful. I was like, okay, what about Zombie? And then the next album comes on, or the next song comes on, and I think, oh, okay, this is good, but what about Zombie? And then like 21 comes on, and that's like another quiet, kind of like mournful song. I'm like, what is this record? This is not Zombie. Did you ever have this experience of like, I bought a record for this song and nothing else sounds like it, and I feel like taken?
100%. There's so much to unpack about what you just said, one of which is the prominence of MTV for our generation in terms of like experience with music cannot be overstated. The like experience with having to like music being something that was scarce, you know, like you had to really choose what genres am I going to be into? What bands am I going to be into? And it was like a statement because you had a limited amount of resources and you spent money on those things.
I don't know, was this true for you in Iowa? There was no radio station playing this music, so I couldn't even like record it off the radio. Like, I had to buy it.
Yeah, well, I feel like I there was like two ways I experienced music when I was growing up, because same, like we had pop radio stations and rock radio stations and oldies, and that was about it.
Yep.
So I experienced music through my parents, which I usually hated. I experienced music from MTV, which, again, very important, and through my friends. And my friends were usually where I found the most, like, indie, like, underground kind of stuff. Because, again, the ones who really cared about that and wanted to be seen as people who cared about that were the ones who would put on, you know, things that weren't being played on MTV, for example. But, like, the reason why I brought that up is because if you bought an album because of a really amazing single and the rest of the album you were not into, you were pissed. You were like, I just spent $20 on this, and this album sucks. This one song is great, and the rest of the album is trash. I think that happened to me 3 or 4 times. The only time I can remember is Sugar Ray, and I don't even know that I, you know, it was worth buying a Sugar Ray album even for that one fucking single back in the 90s.
But you just want
to
fly.
But that's the only one that pops to mind to me, because they again, the whole album was so different from the singles that like made Sugar Ray popular in the 90s. Anyway, but I just, you were there was, again, because music was so scarce, like you were basically gambling on the singles for the rest of the album, right?
Yep. And here, so there's this other thing that conversely would happen to me, which is I'd buy a record because of a single and I didn't love the rest of the record. And that initially was what happened with No Need to Argue. But I didn't own that many CDs. Like, I, you know, it was limited. And I probably owned more than like my friends, because I really cared about it and I spent every extra cent I got on music, and like all my Christmas presents were music. But you know, I didn't have that many CDs. And the way things were in the 90s, because we're old, is you didn't yet. I mean, sometimes I would record some CDs. I would like turn them into mixtapes, right? I could do that. But for the most part, if I'm driving around with my little Discman that I've got, you know, so when I'm 14, I've got my my learner's permit, and eventually I was going to start working. And in Iowa, you could drive to work by yourself with a learner's permit, but only to work and back. So I bought, you know, I had a little tape cassette player in my car, and, you know, I'd plug in the tape adapter into my Discman, and I'd play a full record. Or, like, you know, at home, I would just play a full record. I'd have like a six disc changer or something like that. That was real fancy. And I would just listen to an entire record over and over and over again, including all the filler, including all the songs I didn't like at first. And I would slowly come to love all of them. Like, Stone Temple Pilots Purple is one of these that I think that record is perfect front to back, because for like 5 years, I just listened to it front to back and loved it. And I tried listening to it a few years ago in full, because I had kind of gotten into the habit of just throwing on, you know, Big Empty or something.
Sure.
Interstate Love Song and mixes. But I'm going to listen to this whole record. And it's okay. Like, it's not awesome. And if I heard that now, I certainly would just grab Big Empty and Interstate Love Song and a couple others and put those in a playlist. But back then, I just had to listen to Purple over and over and over again. So no need to argue. Kind of the same thing happens. I like Zombie enough, and I spent $20 on this record, that I'm just determined to like it. And I think this record, more than anything else, maybe Portishead's Dummy, like, unlocked feelings in me that I hadn't totally been exploring. And I was kind of I was an emotionally self-aware kid. Like, I longed for things, and I was sad all the time. And, you know, I was very self-serious. And I think that I thought about my feelings probably more than most kids, but there was something about this record that, like, took me to yet another level. And when I would listen to it, I would think these songs that I can't relate to, because I'm not a woman in Ireland in 1990s where there's war going on. Amidst having your
historical context of something like "Ode to My Family" is intense.
Like, most of her songs are about her getting her heart broken. In the background, there's like a civil war. You know, like, it's just a very different experience than I was having in small town Iowa in 1994. You know, as a guy, as a white guy especially. But I would just find new layers of emotions being opened, and I would think about things. Like, I would ponder things while I was listening to this music, and this music made me, like, want to stick with a feeling a little bit longer than I normally stick with it. And so I think this is actually a really lovely record to put on when you're apologizing to your kids, because it's just all the feels are there. Like, it feels so it's emotive, and it's longing, and it's sad, but it's also, like, quietly hopeful. And some songs are, like, kind of exciting. Like, there's, you know, some really, like, Ridiculous Thoughts is on this record. There's some songs that really go for it. They're pretty, pretty angry. And then there's songs like Yeats Grave that's just beautiful and quiet. So no need to argue. I don't know if this is in my personal canon. I this is right on the cusp for me of, this album meant a lot to me as a kid. I don't listen to it much anymore. But it's been such a pleasure to go back and listen to it over and over again this last week as we prepared for this recording, because, oh man, Dolores, you had this special, this, like, the way her voice, like, carried into the stratosphere, like, this, this, like, Irish brogue, that, where she, like, bend these words in ways that didn't totally make sense. Like, I had to sit down and think about, okay, she said that word, I think, because she said it in a way I've never heard anybody say it before. Because he's, like, stretching all the syllables out to fit, like, four bars of music somehow. And the music is kind of this U2, you know, exciting, but also, like, almost dream pop, almost like shoegazy, sort of. Like, not quite shoegazy, but,
that,
like, flirting with shoegaze, especially, you know, Dreams. But she is front and center, and she's... she's the reason you come back to this record. And
oh yeah, she's the reason. She, I mean, her voice and all that what you're just talking about is the whole reason that Cranberries became so iconic and so influential, right? Like, to your point about female vocalists for the next 20 years wanting to be her, or wanting to at least, like, be in her, on her level, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
for sure.
Oh man, I don't know, like, I feel like the Cranberries feel like one of those bands that was probably bigger internationally than we even realized in the States. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I bet that's true.
Yeah. Also, I had an epiphany while you were talking that we should have named this podcast Two White Guys Who Grew Up in the Middle of the Country in Small Towns Talk About Their Feelings During the 90s.
I mean, I'm okay pivoting our podcast in that direction. I just don't know if anybody's to hear that week after week. But I do think we should do it again next week. Let's do like an origin story episode next week. I mean,
last week we talked about how great 1995 was. This week we talked about how great 1994 was. I feel like we're going to cover off every single year probably at some point.
For our continuity nerd listeners, the thing he's referring to is our first podcast, which we recorded as our third podcast.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. We're fine.
Whatever. 1995 was great. 1994 was great. We will hear nobody speak ill of either of those years.
Nope. And if this podcast goes on long enough, I will deep dive into every single one of those records I listed off. And I'll promise not to just list all of them off again every time.
Do you feel okay? Speaking of canon, I don't think Joy's album, I don't know why I'm calling her on a first name basis like we're friends, is canon for me, but I think that it could be. Like, it's one of those where it just came out really, you know.
Yeah, and a little too recently.
Yeah, and like it all depends on, are there moments where I keep coming back to this? I think that's where it becomes canon for me. Necessarily is canon for me, but I also feel like my canon albums have a higher threshold for me to choose them for episodes. Do you feel like that? Like, where if you're like, if you're gonna pick Kid A, it's gotta be a really great topic to be able to like drop that album. Do you know what I mean?
Well, and not only that, but I want to get better at this before I talk about Kid A. You know, like, so for those of you who don't know me, which is probably half of you, but the other half do know this about me. Like, Radiohead is it. Like, Radiohead, there's like a couple other bands that I deeply love and have absorbed into my identity, but Radiohead is the band. And so if I'm going to talk about Kid A, I want like the gold standard of podcasts. Like, I want to be so good at this and I'm so able to talk off the cuff and eloquently about something, because I just want to like, here's this beautiful thing. I want to talk about it beautifully. And so I'm both punting on it and on a bunch of other records that I love. And also I only get to do it once. I mean, maybe we can do it twice if like our very favorite records, if we have more to say, but I don't know. Like, I think I get to do Kid A once. I get to do, like, we both get to do Midnight Organ Fight once. I don't think we both get to pick it for two different things. Like, we just have to save it for, like, our 100th episode where we, like, get to celebrate. Like, we've done this for 2 years. Now let's talk for an hour about Midnight Organ Fight.
Yeah, seriously. It does feel like the threshold for canon albums is a lot higher for that reason. So yeah, I don't know when we're going to get to albums where I'm like, yes, this is canon for me.
That's well, I think next week I'm going to come with one, because I think we should do an origin story episode, like when we became musically sentient. Yeah. And I want to talk about an album that like really got me.
Yeah, that's a really good topic actually for picking a canon album for sure.
We should probably force ourselves to do canon albums from time to time, because I think, you know, even thinking about this, I mean, we're now meta, talking meta about, we might cut all this out. We are now talking meta about our podcast, a 100th episode of a podcast that we're 4 episodes in, and who knows what's going to come of it, or if anyone's going to listen. But like when recording, I haven't yet released the first episode.
When we are old and gray and recording podcasts from the retirement
then we'll
home.
Finally talk about Frank Ocean's Blonde. I think that we should probably, I think this is a better conversation. Like, this is a very lively conversation because we both deeply care about the thing we're talking about, of course. Not that we don't care about Joy Ladekun, or not that we don't care about, you know, Poison or whatever other records we've talked about so far, even Watch the Thrones. But, you know, there's a special, like, a special layer, and I think we should probably front load some of that.
Yeah, I'm going to cut some of this. That's fair.
So, yeah, we got to do some canon records.
All right.
But
all
for today, no need to argue. I apologize to the Cranberries that it is not going in my personal canon or in the Dave and Caleb collective canon, but it's right on the cusp. Yeah. Like, if we did a second ballot Hall of Fame, it might make it in.
I feel like that's becoming our weekly excuse, though, where it's like every time we're like, oh, I don't know, this could be close, but I don't know. Like, we need to have like a second tier canon.
I've got 250 records, like, you know, ranked. What number do I start?
That's right. What's the cutoff?
And No Need to Argue is not in the 250s, so that can't be it.
Oh, no.
And I don't even know if all 250 belong in a canon. And so, you know, that's what I'm trying to think through. Tell me some of your honorable mentions.
Well, I already mentioned two from Boys to Men, which, again, I think might be a canon album for me for lots of reasons that are personal to me. So that might have been a reason I chose it. But really, really the reason why I didn't go with it is for all that we talked about earlier about, like, a lot of it is just break up, get back together, break up, get back together. Didn't really feel appropriate to children. But on Bended Knee, just maybe one of the best, you know, take me back songs that there is.
Mm.
I also like when I was trying to figure out again, what emotion do I want my children to feel? I was kind of going in that more punkish direction, maybe because of, you know, the music I'm listening to right now. Fortress Around My Heart by Ida Maria was one that I was thinking about. And again,
nice.
I didn't necessarily want my children to walk away feeling like defensive and angry, which that album is, but in a more fun way. Anyway, so those were some of mine. What were some of yours?
I mentioned Michelle and Diocello's Bitter record already. The only other one I really considered was Seven Swans by Sufjan Stevens, which I actually think is his best record, or at least it's the one that I personally love the most. It's not his best record. It's the one I personally love the most. When you started talking about Illinois, I selfishly wanted to jump in and have a 10-minute conversation about Seven Swans, but we'll get to it another podcast. That's a really lovely record about faith largely. And I thought, you know, I thought of that for this episode, but in the end, it could only be No Need to Argue.
Nice. That's the official Dave pick. That's right. It's the right answer.
So now the homework you all have is to do something egregious to your children and then apologize to them with these two records in the background.
That's correct.
All right. Before we call it a day, what have you been listening to this week?
So something fun that I am doing starting today is I'm doing a punk ensemble class.
Oh, what does that mean?
It just means I get to get together with a bunch of people and play some fun punk music. So I've
like,
been kind of
like with your guitar, or play like on a stereo.
No, play with my guitar, like play nice. Sing, like I'm getting together with a bunch of musicians to play punk music for a few weeks. Like, so should be fun. So I've been kind of hyping myself up for that, listening to a bunch of punk records. The one I guess I would call out as particularly fun that I'd forgotten about was Celebration Rock by Japandroids.
Oh yeah.
Super, super fun album. Just, you know, like I feel like a lot of punk is like, again, great to put on in the background, especially if I'm working. I like high energetic music, you know. And there's a few that really pop out to me as like, this is fun, but also like I'm listening to it, you know, and I'm like vibing with specific songs, and Celebration Rock's been a record, like that for me. What are you listening to?
Well, so the answer up until yesterday was this new record by Caroline Polachek called Desire I Want to Turn Into You, which I hope we get a chance to talk about, 'cause it's a really great record. But when we're recording this, yesterday was the day that all the old De La Soul albums became available on Apple Music. And I no longer have to stream them off of YouTube. And I definitely made my kids listen to 3 Feet High and Rising, and they were very confused about why I was making them listen to this. I hope that it ages better than at the introduction went yesterday.
What's the story? Why haven't they been available? I don't know the background.
I think it was a lot of sample clearance and a lot of label issues. The label was kind of holding, I don't know if they were holding a hostage necessarily, but the vibe I got from interviews with them was, we feel like wronged by how long it's taken to get these things streaming. And they've been working to get them streaming for years and years. And they were at some point worried, you know, not, I don't know how worried they really were, but they at some point expressed some sense of, are we going to be forgotten in like the history of hip hop? Because nobody can hear our music. And so, and they have like four or five like masterpiece records.
Right.
And they, all this came out yesterday, like in a, you know, in one fell swoop. And so, I've just been enjoying like being able to play that wherever I go. I have, you know, I have 3 Feet High and Rising somewhere downstairs in a CD binder. But I didn't own a lot of their other records, 'cause you know, I wasn't necessarily a hip hop kid and everything cost $20
to the point we made earlier. Yeah.
Right, but in the era of YouTube, you at least you can go on YouTube and like listen to these records. And so sometimes I would do that, but that's kind of a big hassle. Like listening to a record on YouTube is not an ideal way. If the ways you listen to records are, but even like I'm not gonna play a video in my car and like eat my data plan, you know, like, so, you know, and I can do some tech savvy things to get it, but I didn't want to. I wanted to like support them. And so having it right at my fingertips was really fun yesterday. And I think I'll continue to do a deep dive into De La Soul for the next couple of weeks, which will be really fun.
Awesome. Maybe
the
one
only
of
other song I wanted to flag for you. There is this song called Pawn Shop by Kara Jackson that you immediately need to go listen to because it is awesome.
Oh, we are going to talk about that entire record at some point because it's going to be so good. I'm so excited about it. I do these things. I don't know if I've told you about this, but I do these things where I make playlists for my wife of like new music coming out. Right. And I threw on Dickhead Blues to the last one. And she was like, I can't play this in front of my high school kids. My wife's a teacher. She was like, I can't. No, take this off this playlist. And I was like, oh, fine.
Well, replace it with Pawn Shop because she can play that one.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening this week. We'll be back next week with another episode of Best Album 4. Tell us all the ways that you disagreed with us or are appreciative of us because you indeed did do something you had to apologize for, and this record helped in some magical way. And of course, subscribe to our podcast, leave a review. That'll help us out a lot, and we will see you next week.